The submarine loosed a noisemaker, but it malfunctioned. Another was loaded into the launcher. Too late. The torpedo struck the submarine on her port screw and exploded.
"All right," hooted a petty officer on the sonar crew. "We have warhead detonation. We got the sucker."
"We have impact. We have detonation," confirmed a Hilo crew. "Stand by. Target engines have not stopped completely. Additional propulsion noises. Clanking. Air blowing. He's blowing tanks. Coming up. Target is coming up. We have bubbles on the surface. Hot damn, there he is." The Charlie's bow broke the surface 6 miles from the frigate. Three helicopters circled the wounded vessel like wolves, and Ferris turned north to close the target, her 5-inch gun tracking it. It wasn't necessary. The forward hatch opened, and men began scrambling out. More appeared on the sail, jumping overboard as the submarine's engine room filled with water. A total of 10 got off before the submarine slid backward below the waves. Another appeared on the surface a few seconds later, but no more. The helicopters dropped life jackets to the men in the water. The Hilo, with the rescue hoist aboard, managed to lift 2 men before the frigate arrived on the scene. Morris supervised the operation from the bridge. The motor whaleboat was swiftly launched, and the rescue was an easy one. The Russian crewmen were stunned and did not resist. The helicopters guided the boat to each man, carefully searching the area for more. All 11 were recovered, and the whaleboat returned to the drop lines. Ferris's chief bosun supervised the operation, an ensign standing quietly at his side. No one had seriously considered this possibility. A torpedo hit on a submarine was supposed to kill her entirely. "Prisoners," Morris thought to himself. "What the hell am I supposed to do with prisoners?" He had to decide where to keep them, how to treat them, how to interrogate them. Did he have anyone aboard who spoke Russian? The captain turned the con over to his executive officer and hurried aft. Armed crewmen were already there, holding their M-14 rifles awkwardly, as they looked down with great curiosity at the whaleboat. The boat crew secured the hoist lines to the lift points, and the seamen on the winch lifted the boat up into the davits. The Soviets were not an impressive lot, many of them clearly in shock from their near escape from death. Morris counted 3 officers, one of them probably the captain. He whispered a quick command to Bosun Clark. The chief had his armed party step back and took the whistle from his pocket. As the whaleboat settled into place, he blew a 3-tone note on his whistle and saluted the Soviet captain like an arriving dignitary. The Russian's reaction was one of astonishment. Morris stepped forward to help him off the boat. "Welcome aboard, Captain. I'm Captain Morris, United States Navy." Ed looked around briefly to see the incredulous expressions on his crew's faces. But his ploy failed. The Russian said something in Russian, and either spoke no English or had the presence of mind to pretend he didn't. Someone else would have to handle the interrogation. Morris told his bosun to carry on. The Russians were taken below for a medical check. For the moment, they'd be kept under guard in sick bay. The bosun hurried back for a moment.
"Skipper, what the hell was that all about?" Chief Bosun's mate Clark inquired.
"They've probably been told that we'd shoot them in the head. I read a book once that said the most effective technique...
Look, there was this German, the guy specialized in getting information out of our guys in World War II, okay? He was good at it, and what he did was treat our guys decently. Hell, they sponsored him to come over after the war, and now he's an American citizen.
Separate the officers from the enlisted and the senior EMs from the juniors. Keep 'em separate. Then make sure they're kept comfortable. Feed 'em. Give 'em cigarettes. Make 'em feel safe. If you happen to know anyone aboard who has a bottle, get it, and give our guests a couple of stiff drinks. Everybody gets new clothes. We keep theirs.
Send all of it to the wardroom. We'll see if they have anything valuable. Make sure they're treated nice, and just maybe we can get one or two to spill his guts.
You got it, Skipper.
The chief went away, shaking his head. At least he'd get to paint a whole submarine on the pilot house this time. Morris went back to the pilot house. He ordered his men to secure from general quarters and the frigate to return to her patrol station. Next he called up the escort commander and reported on the prisoners.
"Ferris," the Commodore replied, "you are directed to paint a gold A on your ASRock launcher. Well done to all aboard, Ed. You're the champs for this crossing. I'll get back to you on the prisoners. Out."
The captain turned around to see that the bridge watch had not left. They'd all heard the Commodore on the radio. Their fatigue was gone, and the grins directed at Morris meant more to him than the words of his boss. Kiev, the Ukraine. Alexeyev looked over the intelligence material on his desk. His boss was in Moscow for a high-level briefing. But this data was, should be, he corrected himself, little different from what his commander was hearing.
"Things are not going well in Germany?" Captain Sergeyev asked.
"No. We were supposed to have reached the outskirts of Hamburg by H plus 36. A day and a half, the plan called for. Instead, we're not quite there yet, and Third Shock Army has taken murderous losses from NATO aircraft." He paused, staring at the map. "If I were the NATO commander, I'd counterattack again, right there."
"Perhaps they are unable to do so."
"Their first counterattack was repulsed." "At the cost of a broken tank division and 60 aircraft. Victories like that we can do without. The picture in the south is scarcely better. The NATO forces are trading space for time, and doing it very well. Their ground forces and tactical aircraft are operating over the same ground they've practiced on for 30 years. Our losses are nearly double the estimates, and we can't sustain that." Alexeyev leaned back. He chided himself for being defeatist. It was mainly a manifestation of his desire to join the action. He was certain, as any general would be certain, that he could do things better.
"What about NATO losses?"
"Heavy, we think. They have been remarkably profligate in their weapons expenditures. The Germans have staked too much on defending Hamburg, and it has to be costing them dearly. If I could not counterattack in their place, I would withdraw. A city is not worth breaking the balance of your army. We learned that lesson at Kiev."
"Excuse me, Comrade General, what about Stalingrad?"
"A somewhat different situation, Captain." "Remarkable, nonetheless, how history can repeat itself," Alexeyev muttered, studying the map on the wall. He shook his head. West Germany had too much in the way of road communications for that to work. "The KGB reports that NATO has 2, at most 3 weeks' supply of munitions left. That will be the decisive factor."
"What of our supplies and fuel?" the young captain asked.
His answer was a scowl. Iceland. At least there was water. The streams were fed by glaciers that lay in the center of the island. Water that had fallen as snow over 1,000 years before, long before atmospheric pollution, and been compressed to ice. When finally it melted to fill the rocky streams, it turned back into water of crystalline purity and marvelous taste, but absolutely no nutritional value. It was also ice-cold, and fords were not easily found.
"Down to one day's rations, Lieutenant," Smith observed as they finished off their meal.
"Yeah, we'll have to think that one over." Edwards assembled his trash. Garcia collected it all for burial. If there had been a way to cover their footprints in the dirt, Smith would have had them doing that, too. It wasn't easy. As Edwards assembled his radio, he listened to muttered Spanish curses and the sound of a folding shovel slamming against the loose rocks that passed for soil atop Hill 482. Doghouse, this is Beagle, and we're running out of food. Over.
Sorry to hear that, Beagle. Maybe we'll have some pizzas sent out.
You funny bastard, Edward said without toggling the transmit key.
What do you want us to do this time?
Have you been spotted by anyone?
We're alive, ain't we? Negative.
Tell me what you can see.
Okay, there's a gravel road downhill to the north, maybe 2 miles away.
Looks like a farm.
Plowed fields like, but can't tell what's growing there. Another sheep farm to the west of us. We passed it coming here. Lots of sheep. 10 minutes ago, we saw a truck on the road heading west. Haven't seen anything flying yet today, but I suppose that'll change. The only civilians we've seen have been right by their houses. We haven't even seen farmers with their sheep. And the farm to the north has no visible activity.
No. Say again, zero civilian road traffic.
Ivan's got this island shut down, Doghouse. Really shut down. That's about all I can say. Tell those Vark drivers they really did the job on that powerhouse. Nothing left but a hole in the ground. We haven't seen an electric light lit since.
Copy that, Beagle.
Okay, your orders are to head north towards Vamsfjorder. You need to take a wide detour east to avoid all these bays I see. We want you there in 10 days. Say again, 10 days. 12 at the most. You can make it easy. Stay out in the boonies and avoid contact with anyone. Continue the normal contact schedule and report on anything you see that may be of interest. Acknowledge. Roger, Doghouse, you want us inside of Vamsfjorder at the end of next week, and keep up the usual radio routine. Anything else?
Be careful. Out.
Vamsfjorder? Smith asked. That's 100 miles on a straight line.
They want us to detour east to avoid contact.
200 miles, walking over this shit.
Smith's frown was enough to split a rock.
End of next week? 10 or 11 days?
Edwards nodded dumbly.
He hadn't known it would be that far.
Gonna be a little tough, Mr. Edwards.
The sergeant pulled a large-scale map from his case. I don't even have cards for the whole coastline.
Damn.
Look here, Lieutenant. The ridges and rivers on this rock come out from the center like the spokes on a wheel, you see? That means we climb a lot. And these here ain't little hills. All the low places got roads, and sure as hell we can't follow no roads, right?
He shook his head.
Edwards forced a grin.
Can't hack it? I thought you Marines were in good shape.
Smith was a man who ran 5 miles every morning. He could not recall ever seeing this little Air Force wimp out doing road work. Okay, Mr. Edwards. They say nobody ever drowned in sweat. On your feet, Marines. We got orders for a little hike.
Rogers and Garcia exchanged a look.
Mister was not exactly a term of endearment for an officer. But Smith figured that insubordination only counted if the officer knew he was being insulted.
Keflavik, Iceland. The helicopters took time to assemble. The big AN-22 transport had delivered 2 MI-24 attack choppers, quite a load even for that four-engine monster. Another IL-76 flight had delivered the technicians and flight crews to assemble, service, and fly them. There had been a major oversight in the plan, the general thought. The one helicopter that had survived the strafing attack on the first day was now broken down. And, of course, the broken part was not one which had been included in their prepackaged equipment. There should have been more helicopters.
He shrugged eloquently.
No plan was ever perfect. More helicopters would be flown in, plus a few more mobile radar sets, and some additional SAM launchers. The Americans looked to have every intention of making his tenure on Iceland difficult, and he needed more equipment to counter that. Then there were those KGB bastards. "We have to pacify the island," they said. As if Iceland wasn't already passive enough.
There had been not a single incident of active resistance yet. Not one, the general thought, remembering his year's service in Afghanistan. Compared with that mountainous hell, this was paradise itself. But that wasn't good enough for the KGB. Nekulturni barbarians. 1,000 hostages had been taken, only to learn that there was no jail space to keep them. So my paratroopers must guard the poor harmless wretches, using up a whole company of troops. His orders were to cooperate with the local KGB contingent. One did not cooperate with the KGB, of course. One was dominated by them. There were KGB officers with his mobile patrols, to advise, they put it. General Andreev was beginning to worry. Crack paratroopers were not the sort to be good jailers. Had they been ordered to go easily on the Icelanders, that would be one thing. Instead, their orders forced them to be harsh, which generated hostility. Some people had actually been heard to cheer when the last American bombers had come through. Absurd, the general thought. They had lost electricity, but we had lost nothing. And they cheered. Because of the KGB's orders. What stupidity. An opportunity lost. He considered protesting his orders to his central command in Moscow, but to what point? An officer who disliked the KGB was an officer who disliked the party itself. He was aroused from his reveries by the whining sound of turboshaft engines. The first of the Mi-24 Heinz was turning its rotor, testing its engines. An officer ran toward him. "Comrade General, with your permission, we are ready for a test flight. We're doing it light, unarmed. We'll load weapons when we get back." "Very well, Captain. Just check out the hilltops around Keflavik and Reykjavik." "How long on the second one?" Andreev asked.
2 hours.
"Excellent. Good work, Comrade Captain." A minute later, the heavy attack chopper lifted into the air.
"Down and freeze!" Garcia screamed.
It didn't come close to them, but seeing it was enough.
"What kind is it?"
"Hind. It's an attack bird like the Cobra." "Bad news, Lieutenant. It carries 8 troops and a whole shitload of rockets and guns. And don't even think about shooting at it. Sucker's armored like a damn tank." The Mi-24 circled the hill they'd just been on, then disappeared, heading south to loop over another hill.
"Didn't see us, I guess," Edward said.
"Let's keep it that way. Keep the radio stowed a while, Lieutenant. We can call this one in after we move out a ways, okay?" Edwards nodded agreement. He remembered a brief on Soviet helicopters in the Air Force Academy. "We are not afraid of the Russians," an Afghan had been quoted, "but we are afraid of their helicopters." Bitburg, Federal Republic of Germany. Colonel Ellington awoke at 6 that evening. He shaved and walked outside, the sun still high in the evening sky. He wondered what mission they'd have tonight. He was not a bitter man, but to have nearly a quarter of his crews, men with whom he had worked for 2 straight years, lost in a week, was a difficult thing to accept. It had been too long since his experience in Vietnam. He'd forgotten how terrible losses could be. His men could not stand down a day to mourn their dead and ease the pain, much as they needed to. They were being carefully rested. Standing orders gave them 8 hours of sleep a day. Like night hunters, they slept only by day. They were making a difference, however. He was sure of that. Every night the black and green Frisbees lifted off for some special target or other, and the Russians still had not figured a counter. The strike cameras mounted in each aircraft were bringing back pictures that the wing intelligence officers could scarcely believe. But at such a cost. Well, the colonel reminded himself that one sortie a day was a lighter load than the other air crews were bearing, and that the close support crews were taking losses equal to his own. Tonight held another mission.
He ordered his brain to occupy itself with that task alone. The briefings took an hour. 10 aircraft would fly tonight, 2 planes each at 5 targets. As commander, he drew the toughest. Surveillance indicated that Ivan had a previously unsuspected forward fuel dump at a position west of Wittenberg that was supporting the drive on Hamburg, and the Germans wanted it taken out. His wingman would go in with Durandals, and he'd follow with Rockeyes. There would be no supporting aircraft on this one, and the colonel didn't want jammer aircraft to go in with him. 2 of his lost birds had had such support, and the jamming had merely alerted the defenses. He examined the topographical maps closely. The land was flat. Not much in the way of mountains and hills to hide behind. But then he could skim at treetop level, and that was almost as good. He'd approach from the east, behind the target. There was a 20-knot west wind, and if he came in from leeward, the defenders would be unable to hear his approach until bomb release. Probably. They'd egress the area by heading southwest. Total mission time, 75 minutes. He computed his necessary fuel load, careful as always to allow for the drag of his bombs. To the bare-bones fuel requirements, he added 5 minutes on afterburner, in case of air-to-air combat, and 10 minutes to orbit Bitburg for landing. Satisfied, he went off for breakfast. With each bite of toast, his mind ran through the mission like a movie, visualizing every event, every obstacle, every SAM site to be avoided. He randomly inserted the unexpected. A flight of low-level fighters at the target. What effect would this have on the mission? What would the target look like on this approach? If he had to make a second bombing pass, from what direction? Major Isley ate with his commander in silence, recognizing the blank look on his face, and running through his own mental checklist. They headed straight into East Germany for 50 miles, before turning north at Rottenau. 2 Soviet mainstay aircraft were up, a good distance back from the border, and surrounded by agile flanker interceptors. Staying well outside the effective range of their radar, the 2 aircraft flew low and in tight formation. When they screeched over main roads, it was always in a direction away from a course to their target. They avoided cities, towns, and known enemy depots where there might be SAMs. The inertial navigation systems kept track of their progress on a map display on the pilot's instrument panel. The distance to the target shrank rapidly as the aircraft curved west. They flashed over Wittenberg at 500 knots. The infrared cameras showed fueling vehicles on the roads heading right for the target area. There. At least 20 tank trucks were visible in the trees, fueling from underground tanks.
Target in sight. Execute according to plan.
Raj, acknowledged Shade 2. I have them visual. The Duke broke left, clearing the way for his wingman to make the first run. Shade 2's aircraft was the only one left with the proper ejector racks for the bulky, hard-target munitions.
God!
The Duke's display showed an SA-11 launcher right in his flight path, its missiles aimed northwest. One of his aircraft had learned the hard way that the SA-11 had an infrared homing capacity that no one had suspected. The colonel reefed his aircraft into a hard right turn away from the launcher, wondering where the rest of the missile battery's vehicles were. Shade 2 skimmed over the target. The pilot toggled off his 4 bombs and kept heading west. Gunfire rippled across the sky in his wake. Too late. The French-made Durandal weapons fell off the ejector racks and scattered. Once free, they pointed down, and rockets fired to accelerate the munitions straight at the ground. They were designed to break up concrete runways and were ideal for underground fuel tanks. The bombs did not explode on impact. Instead, the hard steel weapons lanced into the ground, penetrating several feet before detonating. 3 found underground fuel tanks. The Durandals exploded upward, breaking open a path for burning fuel to leap into the air. It was the next thing to a nuclear detonation. three white columns of flame rocketed into the air, spreading like fountains and dropping fuel for hundreds of yards. Every vehicle in the compound was engulfed in flame, and only those men near the perimeter escaped with their lives. Rubber fuel bladders brought to the site exploded a few seconds later, and a river of burning diesel and gasoline spread through the trees. In a matter of seconds, 20 acres of woods were transformed into a fireball that raced skyward, punctuated by secondary explosions. Ellington's fighter rocked violently as the shockwave passed.
"Damn," he said quietly.
The plan called for him to use his cluster munitions to ignite what the Durandals had burst open.
"Don't think the rock eyes are necessary, Duke," Isley observed.
Ellington tried to blink away the dots as he turned away, keeping as low as he could. He found himself flying right down a road. The Soviet commander-in-chief of the Western Theater was already angry, and what he saw to the east didn't help. He'd just conferred with the commander of the Third Shock Army at Zarentin to learn that the attack had again bogged down within sight of Hamburg. Furious that his most powerful tank force had failed to achieve its objective, he'd relieved its commander on the spot and was returning to his own command post. Now he saw what could only be one of his three major fuel depots rising into the clear sky. The general cursed and stood, pushing aside the roof panel on his armored command vehicle. As he blinked his dazzled eyes, a black mass seemed to appear at the lower edge of the fireball.
"What's that?" Ellington wondered.
His TV display showed four armored vehicles in a tight column. One of them, a SAM launcher. He flicked his bomb release controls to armed and dropped his four Rockeye canisters, then turned south. His tail-mounted strike cameras recorded what followed. The Rockeyes split open, distributing their bomblets at a shallow angle across the road. They exploded on impact. Sink West died a soldier's death. His last act was to seize a machine gun and fire at the aircraft. Four bomblets fell within a few meters of his vehicle. Their fragments sliced through the light armor, killing everyone inside even before its fuel tank exploded, adding another fireball to a sky that had still not returned to darkness.
USS Chicago.
The submarine came slowly to the surface, spiraling up to allow her sonar to check the entire area as she rose to antenna depth. His luck had been bad so far, McCafferty considered, which was not a situation that encouraged risk-taking. As the submarine leveled off beneath the waves, the ESM mast went up first, sniffing for hostile electronic signals, then the search periscope. The captain made a quick sweep around the sky, then the surface, his executive officer closely watching the television readout to back up the skipper's observations. Everything looked clear. There was a moderate sea running, with 5-foot swells, and the clear blue sky was decorated with fair-weather cumulus clouds. On the whole, a beautiful day. Except for the war.
"Okay, transmit," McCafferty ordered.
His eyes never left the periscope, which he turned continuously, angling the lens up and down to look for trouble. A petty officer raised the UHF antenna, and the OK-to-transmit light blinked on in the radio room aft of the attack center. They had been summoned to the surface by an extremely low-frequency radio message with their call sign, QZB. The senior radioman powered up his transmitter, keyed out QZB on the UHF satellite broadcast band, and waited for a reply. There was none. He gave his neighbor a look and repeated the procedure. Again the satellite missed the signal. The petty officer took a deep breath and transmitted QZB yet a third time. 2 seconds later, the hot printer in the after corner of the room began to print up a coded reply. The communications officer keyed a command into the cipher machine, and the clear text came up on another printer.
"Top secret. From Com Sublant to USS Chicago.
1. Report large Red Fleet amphibious group departing Kola, 1150 Zulu, 19 June. Force composition, 10-plus fibs with 15-plus combatant escort, including Kirov, Kiev. Heavy, repeat, heavy air ASW support this group. Expect also Red Fleet SS, SSN support this group. Westerly course, high speed. 2. Evaluate objective this group, Badu. 3. Proceed at best speed to 70 north, 16 west. 4. Engage and destroy. Report contact if possible before attack. Other NATO SS, SSN traffic this area. Air support possible, but not, repeat, not likely at present. 5. Will amplify location this group as possible.
McCafferty read the dispatch without comment, then handed it to the navigator.
How long to get there at 15 knots?
About 11 hours.
The navigator took a pair of dividers and walked them across the chart.
Unless they're flying, we'll be there long before they are.
Joe?
The captain looked at his executive officer.
I like it. Right on the 100-fathom curve and water conditions are a little squirrely there. What with the Gulf Stream coming in so close and fresh water coming out of the fjords. They won't want to be too close inshore because of the Norwegian diesel boats, and they won't stray too far out because of the NATO nukes. If I had to bet, I'd say they'll come right to us.
Okay, take her down to 900 feet and head east. Secure from general quarters. Let's get everybody fed and rested.
10 minutes later, Chicago was on a heading of 081, steaming at 15 knots. Deep, but in relatively warm water from the ocean current that begins in the Gulf of Mexico and runs all the way to the Barents Sea, she enjoyed sonar conditions that made detection by a surface ship nearly impossible. The water pressure prevented cavitation noises. Her engines could drive the submarine at this speed with only a fraction of her total rated power, obviating the need for the reactor pumps. The reactor's cooling water circulated on natural convection currents, which eliminated the major source of radiated noise. Chicago was completely in her element, a noiseless shadow moving through black water. The crew's mood changed slightly, McCafferty noticed. Now they had a mission. A dangerous mission, but one they had trained for. Orders were carried out with calm precision. In the wardroom, his tactical officers reviewed tracking and attack procedures long since memorized, and a pair of exercises were run on a computer. Charts were examined to predict likely places for especially bad water conditions in which they might hide. In the torpedo room, 2 decks below the attack center, sailors ran electronic tests on green-painted MK-48 fish and the harpoon missiles in their white canisters. One weapon showed an electronic fault, and a pair of torpedomen immediately stripped off an inspection plate to replace a component. Similar checks were made of the Tomahawk missiles in their vertical launch tubes nested in the bow. Finally, the weapons control team ran a computer simulation through the MK-117 attack director to ensure that it was fully operational. Within 2 hours, they were sure that every system aboard was operating within expected limits. The crewmen exchanged hopeful smiles. After all, they reasoned, it wasn't their fault that no Russian had been dumb enough to come their way, was it? Just a few days before, hadn't they practically landed on the beach? In Russia? Without being detected? The old man was a real pro, wasn't he?
USS Ferris.
Dinner was awkward, to say the least. The 3 Russian officers sat at the end of the table, mindful of the 2 armed guards 10 feet away, and the cook in the wardroom pantry, who kept a large knife conspicuously in view. The officers were served by a young seaman, a beardless boy of 17 who scowled mightily at the Russians as he served the salad.
"So," Morris said cordially, "do any of you speak English?"
"I do."
answered one.
I am instructed, my captain, to thank you for rescue our men.
Tell your captain that war has rules, and so does the sea. Please tell him also that he showed great skill in his approach.
Morris poured some Thousand Island dressing on his lettuce as the message was translated. His officers were keeping a close eye on their guests. Morris was careful to avert his gaze. His remark had the desired effect. A rapid exchange took place at the other end of the table.
My captain asks how you find us. We, how you say, get away from your helicopters, no?
Yes, you did, Morris answered.
We did not understand your operating pattern. Then how you find us? I knew you were attacked earlier by the Orion and that you ran at high speed to catch up with us. The angle for your attack was predictable. The Russian shook his head. What attack is this? Who attack us? He turned to his commander and spoke for 30 seconds. There's another Charlie out there, Morris thought, if he's not lying to us. We ought to get someone who speaks Russian to talk to the crewmen below. Damn, why don't I have one of those? My captain says you are mistaken this. Our first contact with you was from helicopters. We did not expect your ship to be here. Is this new tactic? No, we've practiced this for some years. How you find us, then? You know what a towed array sonar is. We first detected you on that, about 3 hours before we shot at you. The Russian's eyes went wide. Your sonar so good as that? Sometimes. After this was translated, the Russian captain spoke what seemed a terse order, and the conversation stopped. Morris wondered if his radio technicians had wired the microphone into the Russians' quarters yet. Perhaps what they said among themselves would be useful to Fleet Intelligence. Until then, he'd continue to make them comfortable. How is the food aboard a Soviet submarine? Not same as this, the navigator answered after conferring with his boss. Good, but not same. We eat different foods. More fish, less meat. We have tea, not coffee.
Ed Morris saw that his prisoners were going after their plates with scarcely concealed gusto. Even our sub-guys don't get enough fresh vegetables, he reminded himself. An enlisted man entered the wardroom and stood by the door. It was his leading radioman. Morris waved him over. The sailor handed the captain a message form. The special job is done, it read. And Morris noted that the man had taken the time to print it up on a standard message format so that no one would suspect what it meant. The Russians' accommodations were all bugged now. Morris dismissed his man with a nod and pocketed the form. His bosun had miraculously discovered 2 bottles of hard liquor, probably from the chief's quarters, but Morris knew better than to inquire, and these would find their way to the Russians tonight. He hoped the liquor would loosen tongues. Chapter 24 Rape USS Ferris Morris didn't wave at the low-flying aircraft, but wanted to. The French Navy's patrol plane signaled that they were within range of land-based air cover. It would take a very brave Russian sub-skipper to want to play games here, with a screen of French diesel subs a few miles north of the convoy lane, and several ASW patrol aircraft forming a tricolored umbrella over the convoy. The French had also sent out a helicopter to collect the Russian submariners. They were being flown to Brest for a full interrogation by NATO intelligence types. Morris didn't envy them the trip. They'd be held by the French, and he had no doubt that the French Navy was in an evil mood after the loss of one of its carriers.
The tapes his crew had made of their conversations were also being sent. The Russians had talked among themselves, aided by the chief's liquor, and perhaps their whispered conversations had some value. They were about to turn the convoy over to a mixed British-French escort force and take over a group of 40 merchantmen bound for America. Morris stood on the bridge wing, turning every 5 minutes or so to look at the 2 half and 1 full silhouettes that the bosun had painted on both sides of the pilot house. No sense having some jerk on the wrong side of the ship missing them, the bosun had pointed out seriously. Their ASW tactics had worked fairly well. With Ferris as outlying sonar picket and heavy support from the Orions, they had intercepted all but one of the inbound Russian subs. There had been a lot of skepticism on this point, but the tactic had worked, by God. But it had to work better still. Morris knew that things would be getting harder. For the first trip, the Soviets had been able to put no more than a fraction of their submarines into action against them. Those submarines were now forcing their way down the Denmark Strait. The NATO sub-force trying to block the passage no longer had the SOSUS line to give them intercept vectors, nor Orions to pounce on the contacts that submarines could not reach. They would score kills, but would they score enough? How much larger would the threat be this week? Morris could see from their return route to the States that they were adding nearly 500 miles to the passage by looping far to the south, partially because of the backfires, but more now to dilute the submarine threat. Two threats to worry about. His ship was equipped to deal with only one. They'd lost a third of the convoy, mainly to aircraft. Could they sustain that? He wondered how the merchant crews were holding up. They had closed in on the convoy, and he could see the northernmost line of merchies. On the horizon, a big container ship was blinking a light at them. Morris raised his glasses to read the signal. "Thanks for nothing, Navy." One question answered. USS Chicago. "So, there they are," McCafferty said. The trace showed almost white on the screen, a thick spoke of broadband noise bearing 329. It could only be the Soviet task force heading for Bodø. "How far out?" McCafferty asked. "At least 2 CZs, skipper, maybe 3. The signal just increased in intensity 4 minutes ago." "Can you get a blade count on anything?" "No, sir." The sonarman shook his head. "Just a lot of undifferentiated noise for the moment. We've tried to isolate a few discrete frequencies, but even that's all screwed up. Maybe later, but all we got now is a thundering herd." McCafferty nodded. The third convergence zone was a good 100 miles off. At such ranges, acoustical signals lost definition, to the point that their bearing to target was only a rough estimate. The Russian formation could be several degrees left or right of where they thought. And at this range, that was a difference measured in miles. He went aft to control. "Take her west 5 miles at 20 knots, McCafferty ordered. It was a gamble, but a small one. On reaching station, they'd found unusually good water conditions, and the small move risked losing the contact temporarily. On the other hand, getting precise range information would give him a much better tactical picture and enable him to make a solid contact report, and make it by line-of-sight UHF radio before the Soviet formation got close enough that they could intercept the submarine's transmission. As the boat raced west, McCafferty watched the bathy thermograph trace. As long as the temperature didn't change, he'd keep that good sound channel. It didn't. The submarine slowed rapidly, and McCafferty went back to sonar. "Okay, where are they now?" "Got 'em. Right there, bearing 332. XO, plot it and get a contact report made up." 10 minutes later, the report was sent via satellite. The reply ordered Chicago in. Go for the heavies. Iceland. The farm was 3 miles away, thankfully, downhill through tall, rough grass. On first sighting it through binoculars, Edwards called it the Gingerbread House. A typical Icelandic farmhouse, it had white stucco walls buttressed by heavy wooden beams, a contrasting red-painted trim, and a steeply pitched roof right out of the Brothers Grimm. The outlying barns were large but low-slung with sod-covered roofs. The lower meadows by the stream were dotted with hundreds of large, odd-looking sheep with massively thick coats of wool, asleep in the grass half a mile beyond the house. "Dead-end road," Edward said, folding up the map. "And we could use some food. Gentlemen, it's worth the chance, but we approach carefully. We'll follow this dip to the right and keep that ridge line between us and the farm till we're within half a mile or so."
"Okay, sir," Sergeant Smith agreed.
The four men struggled into a sitting position to don their gear yet again. They'd been moving almost continuously for 2.5 days, and were now about 35 miles northeast of Reykjavik. A modest pace on flat roads, it was a man-killing effort cross-country, particularly while staying watchful for the helicopters that were now patrolling the countryside. They had consumed their last rations 6 hours before. The cool temperatures and hard physical effort conspired to drain the energy from their bodies as they picked their way around and over the 2,000-foot hills that dotted the Icelandic coast like so many fence pickets. Several things kept them moving. One was the fear that the Soviet division they had watched airlifted in would expand its perimeter and snap them up. No one relished the thought of captivity under the Russians. But worse than this was fear of failure. They had a mission, and no taskmaster is harsher than one's own self-expectations. Then there was pride. Edwards had to set an example for his men, a principle remembered from Colorado Springs. The Marines, of course, could hardly let a wing wiper outperform them. Thus, without thinking consciously about it, four men contrived to walk themselves into the ground, all in the name of pride.
"Gonna rain," Smith said.
"Yeah, the cover will be nice," Edwards said, still sitting back. "We'll wait for it." "Jesus, I never thought working in daylight would be so goddamn tough. There's just something weird about not having the friggin' sun go down."
"Tell me about it." "And I ain't even got a cigarette," Smith growled.
"Rain again?" Private Garcia asked.
"Get used to it," Edward said. "It rained 17 days in June, on average, and so far this has been a wet year. How do you think the grass got so tall?"
"You like this place?" Garcia asked, dumbfounded enough to forget the sir. Iceland had little in common with Puerto Rico. "My dad's a lobsterman working out of East Point, Maine. When I was a kid, I went out on the boat every time I could, and it was always like this." "What are we going to do when we get down to that house, sir?" Smith brought them back to things that mattered.
"Ask for food."
"Ask?" Garcia was surprised. "Ask, and pay for it, with cash, and smile, and say, 'Thank you, sir,'" Edward said. "Remember your manners, guys, unless you want him to phone Ivan 10 minutes after we leave." He looked around at his men. The thought sobered them all. The rain started with a few sprinkles. 2 minutes later, it was falling heavily, cutting visibility down to a few hundred yards. Edwards wearily got to his feet, forcing his Marines to do likewise, and they all moved downhill as the sun above the clouds dipped in the northwestern sky and slid down behind a hill. The hill, since they'd probably have to climb it the next day, they thought of it as a mountain, had a name, but none of them could pronounce it. By the time they were a quarter mile from the farmhouse, it was as dark as it would get,
and the rain had the visibility down to about 80 yards.
"Car coming."
Smith saw the glare of the lights first. All four men dropped and instinctively aimed their rifles at the dots on the horizon.
"Relax, guys. This road here breaks off the main road, and those lights could just be..."
"Shit!" Edwards cursed. The lights hadn't taken the sweeping turn on the coastal highway. They were coming down the road to the farm. Was it a car or a truck with its driving lights on?
"Spread out and stay awake."
Smith stayed with Edwards, and the two privates moved downhill about 50 yards. Edwards lay prone, his elbows propped up on the wet grass and binoculars to his eyes. He didn't think they could be spotted. The marine pattern camouflage made them nearly invisible in daylight, as long as they didn't move rapidly. In the dark, they were transparent shadows.
"Looks like a pickup, 4x4, something like that. Lights are pretty far off the ground, bouncing around too much to be a track," Edwards thought aloud.
The lights came directly, but slowly, to the farmhouse and stopped. Its doors opened, men got out, and one stepped in front of the headlights before they were extinguished.
"Damn!" Smith snarled.
"Yep, looks like 4 or 5 Ivans. Get Garcia and Rogers over here, Sergeant."
"Right."
Edwards kept his binoculars on the house. There were no electric lights lit. He guessed that this area got its power from Artun, and he'd watched the bombs wipe that plant off the map. There was some internal illumination, though, maybe from candles or a hurricane lamp. It really was a lot like home, Edwards told himself. Our electricity went off often enough, from nor'eastern storms or ice on the wires. The people in that house had to be asleep. Working farmers, early to bed, early to rise. Wears you out and dulls the brain, Edwards thought. Through the lenses he watched the Russians. He counted 5, circled the house. Like burglars, he thought.
They looking for us?
No. If they were looking for us, there'd be more than 5 guys in a 4x4.
That's interesting. They must be looting.
But what if somebody... Jesus, we know that somebody lives there. Somebody lit that lamp. What are they up to?
What gives, sir? Smith asked.
Looks like we got 5 Ruskies. They're playing peeper, looking in the windows and...
One just kicked the door in.
I don't like the way this is going, troops.
A scream confirmed his evaluation. A woman's scream had cut right through the falling rain and made them feel someone's terror, chilling men already cold.
People, let's move in a little. We stay together and we damned well stay alert.
Why are we moving in now, sir? Smith asked sharply.
'Cause I say so.
Edwards stowed his field glasses. Follow me. Another light was lit in the building, and it seemed to be moving around. Edwards walked quickly, keeping low in a way that punished his back. In 2 minutes he was a few yards from the truck that had driven in, no more than 20 yards from the home's front door.
"Sir, you're getting a little careless," Smith warned.
"Yeah, well, if I guess right, so are they. I bet..." There was a sound of breaking glass. A shot rang out through the semi-darkness. It was followed by a blood-chilling shriek, and a second shot, and a third. Then there was another scream.
"What the hell's going on in there?" Garcia asked in a rasp.
A hoarse male voice shouted something in Russian. The front door opened, and 4 men came out. They conferred for a moment, then split into pairs, going left and right to side windows, where all 4 men stood to look inside. Then there came another scream, and it was perfectly clear what was going on.
"Those sons of a bitches," Smith observed.
"Yeah," Lieutenant Edwards agreed. "Let's back off and think about this for a minute." The 4 men retreated about 50 yards and bunched together.
"I think it's time we do something,"
"Anybody disagree?" Edwards asked. Smith just nodded, interested in Edwards's change of demeanor.
"Okay, we take our time and do it right. Smith, you come with me and we go around the left. Garcia and Rogers go around the right. Go wide and come in slow. 10 minutes. If you can take him alive, that's okay. If not, stick him. We try not to make noise. But if you gotta shoot, make goddamn sure the first burst does it, okay?"
Edwards looked around for additional Russians. None. The four men slipped out of their packs, checked their watches, and moved out, crawling through the wet grass. There was another scream, but none after that. Edwards was glad there weren't. He didn't need the distraction. The crawling was a slow, tiring effort that sapped the strength from his arms. Edwards and Smith took a long route, around a tractor and some other implements. When they came into the clear, there was only one man on their side of the house.
"Where's the other one?" the lieutenant asked himself.
"Now what do we do?"
"You gotta stick to the plan. Everyone's depending on you."
"Back me up."
Smith was amazed.
"Let me, sir, I—"
"Back me up," Edwards whispered.
He set his M16 down and drew his combat knife. The Russian soldier made it easy, as he stood on tiptoe, entranced with the goings-on within the farmhouse. 10 feet behind him, Edwards got to his feet and approached one slow step at a time. It took him a moment to realize that his target was a full head taller than he was. How was he supposed to take this monster alive? He didn't have to. There must have been an intermission inside. The Soviet private slumped down and reached in his pocket for a pack of cigarettes, then turned slightly to light one from a cupped match. He caught Edwards out of the corner of his eye, and the American lieutenant lunged forward with his knife, stabbing the larger man in the throat. The Russian started to cry out, but Edwards wrestled him down and slapped his left hand over the man's mouth as he struck again with the knife. Edwards twisted the man's head one way, and the knife the other. The blade grated against something hard, and his victim went slack. Edwards felt nothing, his emotions submerged in a flood of adrenaline. He wiped the knife on his trousers and stood on the man's body to look in the window. What he saw caught the breath in his throat.
"Hi, guys," Garcia whispered.
Two Russian privates turned to face a pair of M-16s. They had left their rifles in the truck. Garcia gestured at the ground with his rifle, and both men went face down, spread-eagled. Rogers frisked them both for weapons, then went around the front to report in.
"Took 'em both alive, sir."
He was surprised to see their wing-wiper lieutenant with blood on his hands.
"I'm going in," Edwards told Smith.
The sergeant nodded quickly.
"I'll cover you from here. Rogers, you back him up."
The lieutenant moved through the half-open door. The living room was empty and unlit. The noise of heavy breathing came from around the corner, and a steady pale light. Edwards approached the corner, and found himself faced with a Russian in the process of unbuttoning his pants.
There was no time for much of anything. Edwards rammed his knife under the man's ribs, turning his right hand within the brass-knuckled grip as he pushed the blade all the way in.
The man screamed and lifted himself up on his toes before falling backward, trying to get himself off the knife. Edwards withdrew and stabbed again, falling atop the man in a grotesquely sexual position. The paratrooper's hands tried to force him off, but the lieutenant felt the strength drain from his victim as he moved farther forward to stab him again in the chest. A shadow moved, and he looked up to see a man stumbling forward with a pistol. And the room exploded with noise.
"Freeze, motherfucker!"
Rogers screamed, his M16 aimed at the man's chest, and everyone's ears ringing from the thunder of the three-round burst.
"You okay, Skipper?"
It was the first time they had called him that.
"Yeah."
Edwards got to his feet, letting Rogers precede him as he backed the Russian up.
The man was exposed below the waist, his pants hobbling his ankles. The lieutenant picked up the pistol the Soviet had dropped and looked